Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, doing away with our fascination and devotion to the average. And in part two, we hear from the executive director of the Fifth House Ensemble, one of Chicago's most important musical groups. They're going to be performing this Sunday for Fine Arts at First. Stay with us. So what does it mean to be average? And is average something that we should aspire to? Should we think about being average or aligning our expectations for ourselves and others according to what is average and what's above average and below average? Is it really possible to assess human beings and all of their complexity within that kind of a strict framework? The way so much of society is put together, it would seem the answer is yes, that that's the way we've always done it. But my morning show guest takes serious issue with that system of looking at the world and looking at ourselves and each other. His name is Todd Rose, and he is the director of the Mind, Brain, and Education program at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, where he leads something called the Laboratory for the Science of the Individual. And it is his contention in his new book called The End of Average that we really need to liberate ourselves from the constriction, from the restraints of averageism, that is, of looking at the world and ourselves and each other with this notion that there is even such a thing as being average, or that is a helpful concept that brings us sort of a greater understanding of life. And in his mind, we need to focus instead on the individual in all of his or her full complexity. And he makes a very persuasive case for it, I must say, in this book, which is published by Harper One, an imprint of HarperCollins. Again, the book is called The End of Average, How We Succeed in a World That Values Sameness. And Todd Rose, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me.
There is a interesting through line of sort of a highly personal element in this book, in that this is a very thoroughly researched book, very sort of academic, quite serious in its approach, and yet there is this element of the highly personal because of your own story and your kind of checkered history in the world of academia. I mean, the fact that you were a student who struggled a great, great deal, and to see that, one would never guess that you were destined for the great success that you've ultimately enjoyed. Tell us more about that history and how that figures into your interest in this notion of what is average.
Sure. So, yeah, I mean, you know, today I'm a professor at Harvard, but I also was a high school dropout. And not only was I a high school dropout, I dropped out with a 0.9 GPA. And I think you have to work pretty hard to do that poorly. But from a very early age, I felt the consequences of having a bad fit between who I was as an individual learner and the system that was created, all based around averages. And like I said, it got so bad that I dropped out of school and I got married when I was 19 and had a child, and ended up working a series of minimum wage jobs and was going nowhere pretty fast. And I ultimately ended up going back to school and to college at night just to try to get out of that life and make a better life for my family. And it was that process of like almost desperation and needing to say, okay, like I need to figure out how to make this work, and learning a lot about myself as an individual that allowed me to make some choices that got me into a better position. And I think that it was experiencing the failure of the standardized system and then figuring out what was possible when you understood yourself and how you could move the system around a little bit here and there to make it work for you that for me exposed this kind of idea that, oh, wow, like the system really knows what's best and it knows how to think about you. And I was, if you buy into that, you're kind of destined just to be slotted in whatever kind of ranked you know, system that wants to place you in. And I mean, I can go on, but it was for me, it woke me up to realizing this system doesn't really work for most people in reality.
Right. I mean, it leaves so many people with unrealized potential. I thought it was interesting when you said something about the system failing or the system failing you. And of course, to an outsider glancing in, it would look just the opposite, that you were failing in this system. But of course, you've come to an understanding that's far more sophisticated than that. That in fact, the problem is with this system that in so many ways arbitrarily chooses, you know, who's average, who's above average, who's below average, and slots them in with this sense of that's who you are and that's what you're destined to be.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, you know, like it's a system that worked really well in the industrial age when we were just trying to figure out an efficient way to batch process people and create sort of standardized workers for an industrial economy. And it was never entirely fair, but it was the best we could do. And the thing for me is that today we have the most diverse economy ever. You know, we need all kinds of talent. We need to get the most out of people's potential. So this batch process approach just simply fails us as a country and as individuals. And it would be one thing if we couldn't do anything about it, but I would contend that, in fact, we can. We can do much better. Mm.
So early in the book, you spell out the central premise of your book, no one is average. And that comes after you've given a couple of really interesting real-world examples of how, in fact, in some amazing ways, nobody is average when it comes to certain things. Maybe the most intriguing example that I think could probably be most quickly shared is the very first one when it came to the design of cockpits for the United States Air Force. And tell us when and how and what was discovered about the erroneous assumption that had been made all along about the best way to design a cockpit.
Sure. So as you can imagine, when you're building cockpits for planes, you can only build one cockpit. And, you know, that cockpit is kind of standardized for every plane. And the goal has always been, you know, pilots have different body size. So how do you build one cockpit that accommodates most potential pilots? And the assumption that had been baked into military design since day one had been you design for an average-sized pilot. And what they would do is they would take, like, say, the 10 dimensions of size that mattered most, and they'd figure out the average for each of those dimensions, and then design the cockpit. And, you know, there's something really intuitive about that. Like, even now, it feels like, right, that would be the best choice. Except for they were having all kinds of problems with fighter jets, with performance, and they just didn't even have enough pilots. And it was discovered by a guy named Gilbert Daniels. He was, like, 23 at the time. And he realized that the concept of average was the problem. And what he did was he actually studied over 4,000 pilots at the time and measured them on all these dimensions. And he just asked a basic question, how many of these pilots were average on these 10 dimensions of size? And the generals at the time said, well, this is silly. Of course, most pilots will be average. But he found there was literally nobody. Not a single pilot was average on these dimensions of size that mattered. And the Air Force, to their credit, realized, oh, wow, we have a problem. And they within a year, banned the use of averages in design. And as a result, got flexible cockpits that improved performance at the time and expanded their talent pool. Mm.
Right after you say your central premise, no one is average, in the very next paragraph you say, it is not that the average is never useful. And I'm glad you say that because, of course, it's not that there's no such thing as something being average, but you're trying to make a really careful distinction here about when the notion or the concept of average is valuable and applicable and relevant and when it's not.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that distinction?
Sure. So the biggest thing is averages are really useful when what you care about is the group, right? So if I'm an insurance company, averages are really what I care about. You know, like, I don't care about any one particular person. I care about the whole group. So averages work really well for that. The problem comes when you want to use that group information to think about one person, right? And it turns out we have a whole science and mathematics behind it that shows you absolutely cannot use that average to tell you about individual people. So as long as we're just talking about groups, it's fine. When it's about you, your kid, your student, it's not okay.
You write at one point, the moment you need to make a decision about any individual, the average is useless. Worse than useless, in fact, because it creates the illusion of knowledge, when in fact the average disguises what is most important about an individual. I thought that was a really, really good point, because I think we are living, of course, in an age where we are just ravenously hungry for data and ravenously hungry for sort of clarification and maybe simplification when it comes to, you know, making a tough choice about who to hire or whatever it might be. And it makes all the sense in the world that we might gravitate to something that seems to convey important, clear information to us. And what you're saying is, in fact, when we gravitate towards this paradigm of the average and who's above and who's below, average, whatever that is, when it comes to judging an individual, we're doing ourselves and the person a grave disservice.
That's exactly right. And you know, of course, we want to make things as simple as possible, but sometimes it becomes so simplistic it's not useful anymore. And I think that's where we're at when it comes to averages and individuals.
So you talk at one point then about being part of what you call an exciting new interdisciplinary field of science known as the science of the individual, in which you focus on individuality in a way that has not been focused on before. Tell us a little more about this discipline. I mean, what other disciplines it draws upon and sort of the scope of this study, the
sure.
science of the individual.
Sure. So basically, it's any field that tries to make claims about individual people has been swept up by this new approach. And so we're seeing it in, you know, neuroscience, in medicine, in, you know, cancer research, in child development, in nutrition. Basically, if we want to make claims about you as a person, we need a different methodology than we've used before. And so basically what this new science does is says, in the past, we used to take a sample of people and we would literally average them together, right? Like when I did brain imaging, we'd put you all in a scanner, give you a task, and then average your brain responses together and publish that with the assumption that, like, that average brain represented some people, right? Like, but it turns out in these fields where we have access to bigger data and we can look at individuals, time after time, it's quite often the case that the average is an artifact. It doesn't represent anyone. And so what's been really neat is that when we stopped trying to look at group averages and said, let's look at patterns of individuality, we've discovered really interesting breakthrough insights that have led to practical consequences. So, and pretty much any major advancement in personalized medicine in the last decade has come from this new approach. And I think we're just really getting started, but I think it's the future.
Hmm. A major portion of your book is a section called The Invention of the Average. And I think we have very little time in this short interview to explore very much of that. But I wonder if you could just say a word about where this sort of ferocious devotion to the concept of the average came from. Maybe this man from Belgium in the early 19th century who has a whole lot to do with where we find ourselves today.
Yeah, so the short version is, you know, it's a guy named Adolf Quetelet, and he was an astronomer. And in astronomy, you use averages a lot when you're making observations. So if 10 different astronomers observe the same thing, it is good to average them together, and you'll usually be closer to the truth. His insight was, if you looked at people that way, because it was the first time they had census data, and there was all kinds of like revolutions sweeping Europe, and he wanted a way to govern people better, and he said, what if focusing on individuals is the problem? What if, just like in astronomy, we just focus on averages? So he invents the term the average man, and he says, that should be our focus. Individuals are error. He literally thinks we're error now, and that we should build policies and practices around the average man. So it's this one person who just invents this, and even at the time, it was weird. Like, people really pushed back, but it was so practically useful. Like, for example, we invented insurance off of it. So people, even though they felt it was strange, it had some value, and it just took off like gangbusters.
It certainly did. And tell us about a man named Frederick Winslow Taylor, because at certain points in your book, you talk about something called Taylorism, which is, I think, helps explain how this concept became so widely implemented throughout society.
Yeah. I wanted to know, like, okay, so this academic comes up with an idea of the average man. Well, there's plenty of academic ideas that never impact the world, right? Like, this is a very abstract thing. And I wondered, how did it come to define the way we think of work and school and everything? And this guy, Frederick Taylor, he is, in the U.S., he is thinking about better ways to organize factories because they were chaotic and wasteful. And he basically comes up with the idea that if you applied this new idea of the average person, if you said there's going to be managers who plan everything, and then we're going to treat every worker like a cog. They have no say. And they use the average to time how long it would take you to do a job, like how many body movements you should make, and then they just standardize the job, and they would pick people who could do that job on average. And that became an obsession. It swept every part of industry all over the world, and it didn't take long from there. If we're going to have this kind of average-based standardized workplace, that you would want an education system that would create standardized workers for that standardized economy. So it's really Frederick Taylor that takes the abstract idea of average man and turns it into a whole philosophy of work.
Hmm. And of course, beyond the world of industry, this this notion also invades the world of education, particularly thanks to someone named Edward Thorndike. You tell us at one point, Edward Thorndike believed that the purpose of schools was not to educate all students to the same level, but to sort them according to their innate level of talent. Why did Thorndike believe so strongly that this was the best way to construct an educational system? And why was he so successful in, or why did that idea ultimately germinate so successfully?
Yeah, so Thorndike was a big disciple of Quetelet and another man named Francis Galton. And basically, he had taken the idea of the average person but said, hey, we don't want to be average. It's true that it's the average of the group is true. It's the real person. But who wants to be average, right? There's clearly people who are better than other people. And he felt like it was just your brain. You had a better brain or a mediocre brain or a worse brain, and that it was a complete waste of time to try to have equality or equity and give people the same kind of opportunities, but that for the system, you just give a standardized experience designed on average, fixed to the average amount of time, and then sort the best from the rest. And so he's the person that invents standardized assessments, which are just the one-dimensional ranking, you know, how far you deviate from average. And he invents most standardized assessments we had. He creates standardized textbooks. And the truth is, it took off because it was capturing a way we were thinking now, right? It was pretty pervasive in our society. But also, at that time, we absolutely had to figure out how to have an industrialized education system that could meet the needs of, like so many people that we'd just never done before. And this gave us a pretty straightforward way to do it.
Hmm. We're speaking with Todd Rose, and his book is called The End of Average. And in the second portion of your book, called Overthrowing the Average, we are shown some dramatically different ways to look at this matter. And one of my favorite moments in this portion of the book is when you talk about the primary research method for averageism, averageanism, that devotion to the notion of the average, however you pronounce it, is aggregate then analyze. Whereas the science of the individual, and that's the discipline that you are part of, instructs scientists to analyze, then aggregate. Can you put that into more sort of everyday layman's terms for us?
Sure. So basically, the way we've done science for a really long time is let me use neuroscience as an example. If you're in my study and I'm studying, you know, say memory retrieval, I would bring, you know, a group of people in, I would put them in a scanner, and I would have them do a task, and then I would immediately average together the results and then analyze it. right? And then I would produce some map of a brain that's the average brain, and I would publish it, and we would talk about these are the areas of the brain that are involved in memory retrieval. The problem is that always just assumed that that average map would actually reflect how individual brains do the task, or else why would we use it, right? But it just turns out that it's actually not true. And so instead, what we do in this new science is to say, let's look at how your brain does this task, right? And then we'll look at how another person's brain does it. And we'll look for common features. But we're not just going to blindly average things together and pretend that that's the right result.
Mm. So your book lays out some much more sophisticated ways by which we can understand each other and understand each other's potential. And you draw on a lot of interesting real-world examples, for instance, from a place like Google, which really refined the way in which it hired its employees and tried to find more far-reaching ways to understand people's talents and potentials. And some of these stories revolve around one of your big three principles about all of this, the fact of talent being something that is jagged. Tell our listeners about this concept of jaggedness and how it applies to the matter of something like human talent, human potential.
Sure. So I'll start just by saying, like, when with the Air Force example, when there was no average pilot, right? The reason why there was no average pilot is that when Gilbert Daniels had looked at every pilot on those 10 dimensions of size, he found that every one of them had what we call a jagged profile, meaning on some dimensions, they were on the high end, and on others, they were in the middle, and on others, they were on the low end, like every single pilot. So what we see is when it comes to body size, there isn't someone who's just average on everything, just like there's not someone who's big on everything, right? Just because you're the tallest person doesn't mean you're the heaviest person. But that idea of a jagged profile, of jaggedness, turns out to be true in every human characteristic that we look at, right? So when you look at intelligence, we can average out all your performance on subtests of intelligence and give you a score of 103, right? But it doesn't really mean very much. Instead, when we look below and we look at how you perform, some people are good on spatial stuff and poor on verbal and vice versa. So everywhere we look in terms of talent, character, ability, we see this thing. People are jagged, and you cannot reduce them to a single score. But, of course, that's what we've done all the time.
Right. And, of course, it's an attractive thing to do if you want to save time, if you want something to be sort of a simple system, straightforward. But you are suggesting that we are, again, doing ourselves terrible disservice by trying to boil down something like talent and ability and potential to something that you can chart on a single line.
Yep, and that's what Google found out, right? So they're hungry for talent, like in that industry, and trying to find people wherever they can find them. They relied on one-dimensional metrics. They used to just say, what's your standardized test score, like your SAT? What's your grade point average, and how prestigious was the school that you went to? And they thought that would be how they would get the best talent. And their human resource person, Todd Carlisle, figured out it actually wasn't working. And so they did this massive study that had like a billion data points trying to figure out what predicts how well you'll do at Google. And it turns out your SAT score doesn't matter at all. Like, it doesn't matter at all. Your grades don't really matter that much. They basically went away from all that and found much more nuanced, sophisticated ways to figure out how to find better talent. And it's worked.
Hmm. And it has not led to chaos. I mean, I think somebody might be looking in on this thing, so you just can't run a company that way. But in fact, you just need to find a way to run a company with at least some of that in its approach. You also go on to say that we need to disavow ourselves of the notion that people have simple traits that sort of carry them through life, that I'm an extrovert, I'm an introvert, and so on, that a much more complex way of looking at that is appropriate. One of the things you talk about in this portion of the book are the so-called if-then signatures that sort of shake us loose from too much simplicity. Tell us about this.
Yeah. So, you know, for a long time, we've thought of that you have traits that just kind of exist independent of any environment, right? So we just average together your performance on different environments and call that your trait, say something like extroversion. But in this new science, when we've gotten away from just looking at average stuff and looking at how you behave in different contexts, we found that, in fact, your behavior, your performance, your personality changes depending on the environment. And it's not that surprising, but like what's really neat, I think about it, is it's not random how you change. So, for example, what we see is you'll have an if-then signature. So if it's extroversion, if you're with close friends, you might be quite the extrovert, right? But at work with colleagues, you actually might be kind of introverted. And that pattern is really stable so that we can predict your behavior with these if-then signatures in a way that thinking that you have some trait just doesn't allow us to do.
Right. And of course, because we often see the same people always in the same context, like I see my coworkers always at work, I see my wife always at home, and so on, we can be lulled into this same simplistic view. The third principle is that of there being many different paths to success, that we should not gravitate to a simple thing where there is one best pathway to achieve great success, and you write about that at great length. At the very end of the book, I think you make a really interesting observation about how there is something, in a sense, anti-American about our devotion to the average. And you really call us to sort of shake loose from that, that if when we talk about this thing called the American dream, it really should be about the individual and cherishing the individual and all that he or she can be.
Yeah, and I think that we've gotten to this point where whenever we talk about individuals, we kind of think of individualism as if it's a political philosophy, right? Like pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
Or selfish, like this. It's all about the individual, yeah, and not about the community.
Yeah, and I think what's important here is I mean, I believe deeply in communities and wanting fair, equitable societies. And I think that, you know, if you realize there's no such thing as an average person, then you can't just say that opportunity, like equal opportunity right now, we talk about it as equal access to the same exact experience, right? But that can't be equal opportunity. And so I think this science suggests a different view, which is we should strive as a society to create equal fit between individuals and their environments. And I think that the way to have good, strong communities is by having a clear sense of valuing individuals for who they are.
Mm. I hope a lot of people will seek out your wonderful book, The End of Average, How We Succeed in a World That Values Sameness, published by HarperCollins. Todd Rose, thank you so much for writing this fascinating book.
Oh, thanks for speaking with me.
And the time is 8:37 on WGTD, your gateway to public radio. And here's part two of our program. That exquisite and haunting music by Arnold Schoenberg is from one of his most intriguing works called Verklärte Nacht, which means Transfigured Night. And it is the featured work of what promises to be a most engrossing concert coming up this Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock as part of the Fine Arts at First series at First United Methodist Church in Kenosha at the corner of Sheridan Road and 60th Street. And I'm very, very excited to be able to talk to the executive director of the Fifth House Ensemble, that marvelous chamber group based in Chicago that has been such an important part of the cultural life of Kenosha, initially with its connection with Carthage College as ensemble in residence, and after that, other performances which they have given, including beautiful contributions they've made to the Fine Arts at First series. And this beautiful work is just one of the pieces that they are going to be playing on Sunday afternoon's concert. Melissa Snoza is their executive director and also flutist with the ensemble. And Melissa, it's great to welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you. Great to be back.
First of all, there may be some listeners who aren't yet directly acquainted with the Fifth House Ensemble, and I think it's really important that everybody understand the kind of group that we are talking about, your legacy, and really what you're all about. First of all, sketch the history of when Fifth House Ensemble was first organized and around what principles.
Absolutely. So we first organized as an ensemble in 2005. So we're entering our 10th season right now, which we're really excited about. And the whole idea that we had when we came together, first of all, we wanted to create a group that had a large mixed instrumentation structure. So that means that we're not just a string quartet or a wind quintet. We're actually both, plus a piano. And that allowed us to create a lot of different instrumental combinations in between. But more importantly, we're really interested in the concept that people love classical music. They might just not know it yet. And it's our job to give them as many ways as possible to reconnect with that as part of their daily lives. So right now, the way that that happens is through the concerts that we develop in the Chicago area and then take out on tour. And that's really our sandbox for playing with different ideas, collaborating with different types of artists, like animators, actors, dancers, and then also helping communities to tell their stories through social and civic practice projects that we develop in their neighborhoods. We also do a lot of educational work. So we've been doing arts integrated programming in public schools since 2005. And also a lot of our work now is in training the next generation of musicians. So we partner with the nation's top music schools and conservatories on residency partnerships and curriculum. And also we've been hosting the Fresh Ink Festival in Kenosha every summer, where we bring together artists and ensembles and composers up to age 32. For a really extensive entrepreneurship and creative presentation curriculum, and also to present something like 11 concerts in 14 days. So it's a really great opportunity for the community here in Kenosha to have a chance to experience what they're doing.
It's really amazing. Say a word about some of the intriguing places where your performing takes place. I mean, in sometimes quite unconventional settings, and what kind of a difference you think that makes in who you are and what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the first ways that we thought to reach people was to just change the conversation around where a classical concert could be. So, you know, back in 2005, that was some of the first questions we asked ourselves was, you know, where would we like to see music and we currently don't? So for us, it kind of began in places like bars or restaurants or libraries or train stations. I think we took over the Arlington and Heights train station once for a morning, which was hilarious. I think that we actually had to pretend that somebody was getting engaged to someone else so that the cops wouldn't throw us out, but they sort of figured it out halfway through. But in any case, we also have been now growing to different kinds of things. So we've been working with communities to develop concerts over the course of a year, for instance, and in engaging those communities, we play everywhere from, you know, a local farm to a farmer's market to the Kiwanis Club. You know, anywhere that people would gather, we would typically see a performance. But we also do larger scale partnerships with institutions and festivals that you wouldn't expect. So one of my favorite examples was we played Voice of the Whale at the Shedd Aquarium on the same day that the Baby Beluga Whale was open to the public for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Or we're also getting ready now to premiere the first video game score ever to be nominated for a Grammy Award. We're doing an interactive version of that score, so responsive to the actions of a live game player on stage. We're premiering that at the Music and Gaming Festival in the D.C. area, and that's a festival that attracts 17,000 to 20,000 people a year.
Wow. So that's a video game where there is music in the background, and you're going to create some sort of situation in which someone will be playing the game, and I suppose projected on a screen, will see the action of the game, but you will be playing the music live and somehow responding to, in a sense, how the game is going for whoever is playing it.
Absolutely right. And the game is called Journey. The composer is Austin Wintory, and this is a project we've been waiting probably about 2 or 3 years to do. And we just launched a Kickstarter campaign 3 weeks ago to support the first leg of the tour, which is something like 4 performances. And we were fully funded in 2 hours. We've now raised more than 6 times our goal, which is really exciting. And it just shows you how much people love the game and love the experience. And we couldn't have picked a better opportunity to experiment with that kind of interactivity, because the game, the reason why it was nominated for a Grammy Award is because the interaction between the music and the action on stage or on the screen is so incredibly seamless and beautiful. And it's a game that the first time I played it, I cried 3 times just because of what it made me feel. And you think about what a piece of art does. You know, this is definitely the best argument for games as art that I've ever seen.
Wow. By the way, what happens in the game?
So it's interesting that you ask that, because a lot of times people think, you know, if you're going to play a game, you know, it's a race to the end, or you're going to get all these points or shoot people, and that's not at all what happens. In the beginning, you are dropped into a desert, and you're a sort of a faceless avatar in a cloak, and you have this vague notion that you have to move towards this mountain, but the game does not give you any instruction, and there is no dialogue whatsoever. And as you go through the game, you start to realize what your purpose is in being there, and there are actions that you take, and there are challenges. But the most compelling part of it is that you're playing live on the PlayStation Network. So along the way, you have the opportunity to meet an individual who is also playing online, who is anonymous to you. You don't know who they are, and you cannot speak to them.
Hmm.
But you can sing individual notes at each other, or chirp in the way that they call it.
Huh.
And so that's a way that you can develop some kind of language to help each other out, because what you start to realize is that when you touch each other, you can fly. And there are certain things you can only do with the help of that other person.
Wow.
And the thing that is amazing to me about the game, in addition to how beautiful the music is and how beautiful it is visually to play, and also how gorgeous the story is by the time you're done, because the game only takes about 90 minutes to 2 hours to play. The thing that is astounding to me is that people play this game over and over and over again for the joy of helping other people discover it for the first time. Because you can see, because of the color of the robe that a person wears, how many times they've played the game. And those who are more experienced, I've run into many of those as I played the game, you know, a few times, who will literally sit with me and help me to figure out the challenges of the game and show me where the hidden things are. And that is a very different way of interacting than what we're used to expecting from a game.
Wow. That really sounds intriguing, as does the way in which you're going to be interacting with it with this upcoming live performance. That really sounds terrific. How long have you been executive director of Fifth House?
Since the beginning. So
I did not realize that somehow.
Yeah.
So I was going to ask you a question about at what point did you feel the urge to make that leap from just playing flute in the ensemble to being the executive director, but you made the leap right from the start.
I did. I jumped in with both feet. And, you know, it's funny. I'm a little bit of a weird animal in the sense that I kind of need both of those sides of my brain to be functional in order to be healthy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've had periods in my life where I've been either just on the administration and academic side or just on the performance side. And I'm just a person that likes to see both happen in my life. So Fifth House has been the perfect opportunity for me to exercise that.
Mm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking in this portion of the morning show with Melissa Snoza, executive director and flutist for the Fifth House Ensemble, based in Chicago, but very, very well known around these parts for the beautiful performances which they've already delivered, their Fresh Ink series, which occurs during the summer. And their next performance in the area is coming up this Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock at First United Methodist Church as part of their Fine Arts at First series. And it is a concert which is going to include one of the transcendently beautiful masterworks of the 20th century, Verklärte Nacht, or Transfigured Night, by Arnold Schoenberg. Melissa Snoza, tell us how Sunday afternoon's concert got put together. Was it entirely up to you in terms of constructing the repertoire for this particular program, and how did this program take shape?
Sure. So this particular program is a marriage of two of our favorite programs that we have put together over the last year. So the first is the reason why we're here in the first place, for Verklärte Nacht, which, you know, that was a piece that we got as a suggestion from one of our players. You know, every year we sit together in a room and we say, what are the pieces that we need to play before we die? And one of those was Verklärte Nacht. And we were thinking to ourselves, what are we going to do with this piece? We knew that we had done projects before with animators, with illustrators and using stills. But this was a piece that, because of how romantic and beautiful and lyrical it is, would really benefit from movement. So we worked with an animator for the first time on this project to create the visuals that are at once evocative of the storyline of the piece and the poem that goes with it, but also abstract enough to just incite your imagination. And I think she did a beautiful job of capturing that balance. And the other half of the program comprises of pieces that we premiered as part of our ensemble. We played for the first time over the summer and in the fall. They're pieces by two of our favorite composers, Stacey Garup and Dan Visconti, who happen to be the faculty that we work with every year in Kenosha at Fresh Ink. So of Stacy's pieces, we have Frumenti, which is Italian for fragments. And we also have one of my favorite works of hers, which is called Silver Dagger. It's a piano trio that is just arrestingly beautiful. And then Dan Visconti is contributing Soundings, which is a piece that was written for the Taos Ensemble. It's a flute, cello, and piano trio that is hilarious. I mean, it engages humor in the most amazing way. And it's sort of the dark tale of the love story that exists between chamber musicians. You're sort of in a professional marriage with each other. So what are the many hilarious things you do to one another as you're making great music? And then there's also another piece by him called Low Country Haze, which is another one of my favorites of his. Again, it's just 5 minutes of gorgeously luscious playing. So so the rest of the program involves those favorites of ours, and we're really excited to bring them to you.
For any of our listeners who are not directly acquainted with Verklärte Nacht, tell us a little bit about this really intriguing piece and why it has such a special place in the hearts of so many chamber musicians.
Mm-hmm. So it's actually one of the first pieces of program music. And it's funny that we're playing it because as a group, so much of what we have done is to engage the idea that music can tell a story. And we do that through collaborations and using pieces that weren't necessarily written by the composer in order to do so. But this is a piece that really was. So there's a poem also called Verklärte Nacht, which is the story of a couple, a woman and a man walking together in the night. And the woman has a confession to make that she is pregnant and that the child does not belong to the man that she's with. And there is this incredible transfiguration of acceptance that, you know, he says, you know, the night has transformed our love and this child, and the child will now be mine, and I accept you and I forgive you, and we will walk together in the night, you know. And it's a beautiful story, and I bring this up because the work was premiered in 1902, so you can imagine that there were a lot of things about that would be difficult for people to accept. I mean, he also there were a lot of reasons why the premiere was controversial, the subject matter of it, the way that it was created, and then also, I mean, something like the inverted ninth chord that he uses for the first time, which for those of us nerds out there, you know, people didn't accept it because they didn't believe it existed, you know, at the time. There are all these things that are controversial about it. But the work was originally written for a string sextet, right? A small chamber work. And then it was expanded to a string orchestra. So again, not involving any winds. The version that you'll hear on Sunday is a arrangement of the work that was created specifically for Fifth House. So for the first time, you're hearing that work in a large mixed instrumentation chamber ensemble that includes wind. So it totally changes the color, but it's hauntingly beautiful that way. And it really stretches us as wind players to be able to create those beautiful lines.
That work originally conceived for string instruments.
Yes.
Wow. Yeah. So your lungs get to keep up with the bows. And
Yeah.
Wonderful. Wonderful. And it's one of those pieces, too, in which, of course, we hear the side of Fifth House that has always been there, but we don't always immediately think of it, namely music which is that old. Of course, there's a lot of music that's much older than that, but, of course, we first think of Fifth House for the brand-new music that you're helping to bring about. What does it feel like when you go back more than a century and play music of another era?
You know, it's interesting. A lot of people, since our formation in 2005, thought of us as a new music group because at the time there weren't as many of those. You know, so it was distinctive that we did do a lot of new music, but we actually have never branded ourselves that way. And typically our repertoire has been a large percentage new music, but also connecting that to existing and canonic masterworks. So it's actually typical. It's a hallmark of the way that we program to be able to create links between music that we love that has existed for a long time and music that is being written today. So this is kind of a great example of that. And I will say that the challenges for the performer of working across that many centuries and, you know, in the way that we work often across genres as well, I mean, you have to be incredibly flexible in order to do that. But I have to say that both sides win when that happens. You know, if you're able to bring a modern mentality to something that was written a really long time ago, or if you're able to bring the fundamental beauty of sound and lyricism that you would get from playing masterworks like Beethoven to new music. There are incredible things that happen when you're able to do that. I'm not going to say it's easy, but it's great. It's very rewarding.
Very good. Yes, and I was certainly well aware that you perform all kinds of different things. It's just that the new pieces often sort of galvanize the headlines, so to speak. But I so appreciate the fact that that you knit together the old and the new, the tried and the true and the brand new in so many intriguing ways. And I'm glad to hear that this concert coming up on Sunday will be more of the same. Tell us a bit more about the two newer works that are on this concert. I guess not even, you've already kind of spoken about those specific pieces, but maybe a little bit about the process, what the process feels like when Fifth House takes on a piece that has maybe been composed for them, for you. Mm-hmm. What is that like? And is even in the composing phase, is there some sense of collaboration that occurs?
That is such a great question. And of the works on the program, the only one that was specifically written for Fifth House is Soundings, which is the trio that I mentioned by Dan Visconti. And Dan is actually a member of our ensemble. He's the 11th member of Fifth House. And he's not a performer, but he is our composer on our roster. And as such, we've had the opportunity to work with him on a number of pieces. And this one, I think, was the most collaborative by far in the way that it was constructed. You know, it's funny, usually when you seek funding for the creation of a new work, you have to explain what it is that that work is going to be in pretty vivid detail. Like, what is it called? What is it about? What are the instruments? And when we did our grant applications for this, for Chamber Music America, Dan specifically left that question open-ended because he said that he wanted to create something that would really reflect the collaboration that he has, the opportunity that he has to work with musicians as part of an ensemble rather than a commission that he's being hired to do. So it was really interesting that in the creation of Soundings, we had the opportunity to sit with him individually and say, what's possible on our instruments? I mean, Dan and I sat together for a couple of hours and just went through pieces in our repertoire as flute players that, you know, develop extended techniques in a variety of different ways, and I gave him a whole bunch of scores. But the other thing that's interesting is that he knows us musically and professionally and personally really well. So every movement of that piece is a love letter to us in a certain way, either one that we're going to really appreciate and really adore playing, or one that he knows is going to kind of tick us off a little bit. So, you know, I don't want to give away too much of what's going on here, but I will say that, you know, the piece is as much performance art as it is a piece of music. And it's going to be really, really obvious to the audience what is happening after a certain point. And so I'm going to encourage people who are listening to this piece to come up to us afterwards and say, hey, was this the particular thing that he was trying to do to you in this movement?
Ah.
It's going to be pretty clear.
Wow.
But, you know, the thing that was really amazing to me as we started to rehearse this, because I understood where the gags were and I understood what was going to go on in terms of the really obvious stuff. But what became really profound to me is that he created a piece that communicates so well what it means to be a chamber musician, that you're in this kind of professional and musical and artistic marriage with other people, and you have to figure out a way to work with one another. You start to know each other so well that you know where all the buttons are, but there's also this incredible way of working together where you respect all of your ideas and you have to choose one, and then you have to experiment with a few more. And this is a piece that actually brings that to the table in a way that's theatrical and really fun to watch.
That really sounds intriguing. Should be a lot of fun. So we want to remind our listeners once again that Fifth House Ensemble's next performance here in the area is this Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock, a concert which will include Schoenberg's beautiful Verklärte Nacht, so fitting for Valentine's Day, and also newer works by Stacey Garup and Dan Visconti. The concert at 3 o'clock and free, open to the public. So do not miss this opportunity to enjoy some first-rate music making and to enjoy three very, very intriguing and wonderful works. Melissa Snoza, Executive Director of the Fifth House Ensemble, thank you for joining me.
Thank you.